from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Tracy Kidder has been acknowledged as a master of literary journalism, and in previous books he's written about the development of an early microcomputer, profiled a doctor on a mission to cure disease in developing nations, and depicted the day-to-day drama of a family building its first new house. Now with longtime editor Richard Tott, Kidder reveals the secrets of great storytelling in his new book, Good Prose, The Art of Nonfiction. His other books include Mountains Beyond Mountains and Strength in What Remains. He'll join us for the hour next, right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Pulitzer Prize and National Book Award-winning author Tracy Kidder joins us in studio for this Forum Hour. He's the author of Strength in What Remains, My Detachment, Mountain Beyond Mountains, Hometown, Old Friends, Among School Children, House, and The Soul of a New Machine. And he recently published a book co-written with his editor, Richard Tott, called Good Prose, The Art of Nonfiction, Stories and Advice from a Lifetime of Writing and Editing. Tracy Kidder, good to have you back on Forum. Welcome.
Thanks, Michael. It's nice to be here.
Well, let me begin by just telling listeners this is a book that helps you just in writing narratives and essays and memoirs, but it's a memoir itself. It's really a story about your relationship with your editor. It also has some elements of style and usage in it, trying to just give a picture of what the book is. But it's really a story of almost really a co-authorship.
It is. It's the story of a collaboration and a friendship that lasted. This year, I realized the other day, was the 40th year that he's been my editor. And I think that's pretty unusual, actually. It's pretty unusual in any department of life, that two people could get along for that, for such a long period of time. He's just a very funny intelligent fellow. And I think he's been of much more use to me than I to him. He wanted to write this book. I would never have had the chutzpah to write a book about writing, but it was really fun to do, in part because it was a species of revenge for me. I got to edit him for a change. And he's just fun to work with. He always makes me laugh. I was thinking, we have rituals that we've developed over 40 years, of course. And one of them is the ritual of when we're really finished with a book, when he's pretty much declared that it's done, and we get, and you go.
He declares, you don't declare?
He pretty much declares, yeah. Yeah. You know how that is, Michael. You don't know when you're done. You could go on forever. But, we get the copy edited manuscript, and then finally the page proofs come, and we read the book aloud to each other. He reads a page, I read a page. And one makes notes, and we fix little problems. But while we're doing that, we also write the bad reviews. This is a kind of magical thinking. Because everyone knows that if you fully imagine an event, it's already happened in a sense, doesn't have to happen again. But I remember his calling me on the phone to tell me that a very bad review had appeared and saying, Kidder, we call each other by our last names, Kidder, there's one review we forgot to write. And he wrote the best bad review for this book, too, the other day.
What was the bad review? What book was the bad review that...
That was a book called
You Forgot
Old
to
Friends.
Write. And yes. Where did it appear? I'm just curious about it.
In the New York Times.
In the New York Times.
Years ago. Yeah. And it really upset me for years because I was it was very good for me, actually, in retrospect.
Well, yeah. I think, in fact, not only are bad reviews sometimes good, but editors can be good. Editors can, in this case, you're giving him a heap of credit, and they are often the unsung heroes in books being brought to birth. But, the editors that are often remembered are the fiction editors. You think Gordon Lish, Maxwell Perkins, names like that. This is a book about nonfiction. And
right. Well, nonfiction, I fear that many people, when they hear the term, think that this is a place you go to for fact only. Well, sometimes fact. And, of course, it covers a huge amount of territory, and it's very, very old. I mean, it's at least in Western culture, it's at least as old as Thucydides, right? The Peloponnesian Wars. And there's been a tremendous amount of elegant nonfiction writing over the years, and you know, including forms of storytelling. And I don't think that the art of storytelling, that the techniques of storytelling ever belonged exclusively to fiction.
No, it's in just, fact, remember all the hoopla about new journalism, all that talk about Tom Wolfe and those writers, that was going to be a way to create narrative styles and techniques of fiction and bring them sort of in a connection with journalism.
Right. Wasn't really new, though. It had already been done.
Yeah, of course.
Orwell had been doing it, for instance. I mean, I think in Orwell's body of work, the most distinguished stuff is his nonfiction, not his fiction, which he's best remembered for.
But new journalism was also a way of saying we can maybe fictionalize journalism, and that's something that you guys steer clear of.
For me, I just draw a line there. One of my heroes, literary heroes, John McPhee, once said basically that, you know, no one makes rules for everybody. And I don't mean to do that, but I just think if you call something nonfiction, it ought to be factually accurate, which isn't the same thing as saying I've never made a mistake and printed, you know, something that was inaccurate. It's just that I never did it on purpose.
It's also not saying there isn't subjective truth.
Yeah, I mean, but as we write in here, you know, subjectivity, if it's properly understood, is really just another name for thought. And obviously, all storytelling, fiction, nonfiction, you know, press releases, that's fiction. you know, they all depend on selection. You don't tell everything. Of course, it's you know, a moment's thought tells you that all of this is subjective. It's just that, you know, you're not creating characters. You're not inventing dates. You're or inventing events. At least if you call it nonfiction, at least that's the way I feel about it.
Talking with Tracy Kidder, who is co-author with his editor, Richard Todd, of a book called Good Prose. Let's talk a bit about the writing process and start sort of where you guys lead off with the lead, L-E-D-E, by the way, as any well-trained journalist student knows. Always supposed to grab your attention and, you know, get you excited about reading or suspenseful or whatever. You say, man, a lot to be said about a quiet beginning, and bring this wonderful example, Call Me Ishmael.
Call Me Ishmael, yeah. Which is not you know, a great thundering line from the pulpit, as sometimes people I think it's quiet. Call me Ishmael. You know, the most famous line in American literature, probably opening line in American literature. I think we both agree on this that quiet beginnings are often best. That, you know, these sort of standard lines about how you have to grab your reader, or you know, They all suggest compulsion, almost like it's almost like a mugging. You know, you don't necessarily have to do that. What's necessary in a piece of newspaper writing, what's really important is getting the facts of the story right out, the most important facts right out in front at the very beginning. Doesn't often work, it seems to me, for longer forms of writing, nonfiction writing. Often those most important facts are a place to get to, not to begin, you know, to arrive at.
But you still have to be, and I think this is pointed out in your book as well, constantly aware that you not only are providing a service to the reader, but the reader has to have a stake in what you're writing.
Absolutely. And the way we put it is that you ought to imagine for your, you know, you want your reader to trust you. You have to really start by trusting your reader too, and at least imagining for that your reader is as smart as you think you are. You know, of course, you have to grab the reader's participation. If you're writing in the kind of writing that Dick Todd and I have done for 40 years, which is sort of factual narratives, I think the real engine of those narratives is often, you know, the depiction, the attempt to catch the reflection of a human being on the page. And that requires the reader's participation more than almost anything. And the idea is to get life off the page and into the reader's imagination. The ways in which you can do that, the ways in which the masters have done that, are too various even to begin to talk about. Seems to me, but it can be done. We know it can be done.
And it can be done with fidelity to facts, although you talk about the facts and the facts beyond the facts, and you also talk about restructuring the facts in terms of, say, linearity or mm-hmm. just what's observable in mm-hmm. chronology.
Mm-hmm. Well, just telling a story straight up chronologically, I mean, sometimes that's the right way to do it, but that it's not a violation of the of the truth of a story to tell it in a different order, as long as you don't invent dates, it seems to me. And indeed, it may be that the that what's really important in a story gets unlocked in that way by by not telling it in strict chronological order. I should be able to come up with a good example right away, but I can't.
Well, there are a lot of good examples in the book. I wonder, though, you spent a lot of time talking about the importance of point of view. You tell a story, for example, and you tell it from the first person, it becomes a very different story than if you tell it from the third person,
right,
and the effect on the reader as well as perhaps what comes across from you as a writer. How do you make that decision?
I try not to make it reflexively. I mean, I think it's one, I always hope, I think we always hope that we journalists that, you know, after you've gone out into the world and gathered your story, that somehow the way in which you tell it will grow organically from the material itself. And I hope that point of view comes out, you know, that the decision about point of view arrives in that way. Sometimes it just seems obvious. But it also has to be in combination with where you feel you ought to stand as the person telling this story. So the book that I wrote about Dr. Paul Farmer, Mountains Beyond Mountains,
wonderful book, by the way. Yeah.
Thank you. Well, thanks.
In fact, we talked about it on the air.
Yeah, we did. Yeah. My memory grows furtive, as A.J. Liebling once said. Sorry, Michael. But I think you need the first person in a book like that, where you're writing about such an improbable character and where you need to sort of act as an everyman for the reader.
In fact, you write about in good prose trying to write about Farmer from a third person,
yeah,
and realizing that it just wasn't working.
Yeah.
So to some extent, it's trusting your gut, maybe, isn't it, too?
Yeah. Yeah, I write by rewriting. I mean, and I mean really rewriting. What I do is I start out and I just write as fast as I can, an enormous length, and it's usually a big mess. I write fast, I like to say, so as to prevent remorse for having written badly. And then I start rewriting again, you know. And Todd, one of his great attributes as an editor is that he never crushes, the tender shoots of a book or of a story. He manages to tell you what he thinks, and to help you get going, start it again on it. But I mean, I don't think I've written a book with him that's gone through fewer than 10 versions, some of them quite substantially different early on. You know,
you're talking about like complete reordering drafts?
Well, by the fifth or sixth one, hopes not. But usually there's some major revision that happens later. I'm just a slow learner, Michael.
Well, thank heavens you've had Todd, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's one of the things that certainly comes through here, although I want to talk a little bit more about that relationship with you, particularly since he talks about writers as being narcissists and having a distorted sense of reality. I mean, he's not necessarily that kind where writers are concerned, except he says there's nothing harder than being a writer, which to some extent I agree with, and part of me also recoils at. But what would you have to say about editors? I mean, there's a wonderful poem by Gwendolyn Brooks about the editors of the world, but she's talking about people who, you know, try to impose their opinions on us. I mean, bad editors, perhaps.
Uh-huh.
But the role of editor to you has been instrumental in your success.
He doesn't. He tries hard not to impose his own even his own style on what a writer does. And I'm sure it's impossible to some degree. I have done some editing myself, so I know how easy it is to begin to try to impose your own style or your own vision of things on the author. And he's very good at not doing that.
And he's also the one who doesn't get the glory. You know,
exactly.
You mentioned, introduced Tracy Kidder, Pulitzer Prize, National Book Award winner. This is your midwife. I mean, this is the guy who played
exactly
a central role. I come on the air here talking from the microphone. There's Dan Zoll, you know, behind the scenes, along with Irene and Judy, you know, kind of making things happen. But the glory, as well as the brickbats, as well as the bad reviews and everything, come to us.
Yeah, yeah. And I do, you know, I do most of the work. I have tried to acknowledge him, you know, over the years. The Soul of a New Machine, I dedicated to him, sort of in thanks. He's a good writer himself, by the way. He published a lovely book called The Thing Itself, which didn't get a lot of attention, but it's a really very fine piece of writing.
Well, you both are talking about writing in ways that make a good deal of sense. You talk about writing as talking to strangers. I mean, that's Vonnegut's great advice, you know, write for strangers. But also the writer should think of himself as a, or herself as a guest, let's say when interviewing, and trying to get as much from the person as they will divulge or they will tell in the story and everything. What about that Janet Malcolm idea, though, that the writer plays a role almost manipulator and having to put on this fake persona to get information?
So. Well, that's a big, big subject. She's not entirely wrong, and I think her Jeremiah, which is really what it is, shouldn't be dismissed. On the other hand, I think she willfully ignores, first of all, the case that she wrote about in her famous book is one of those ones that lawyers talk about, interesting cases making bad law. It's a really unusual and fascinating case. I think she ignores all the good work that can be done, some of the good things that can come out of these relationships. But I would never, it would be completely dishonest for me to say that that's not the most sort of painful part of this whole process. I mean, I go out and I generally write about people whom no one's ever heard of before, though Paul Farmer's certainly an exception. And so-called.
You made Paul Farmer far more famous, though. I mean.
Oh, I don't know about that. I think he was on his way. Yeah. Anyway, I was grateful for the opportunity. But I ask for the right to people to give me the access to their lives, basically the right to invade their privacy. I feel as though I should be a good guest in their lives. I do feel as though, at the end, my first obligations are to my readers. But I wouldn't willfully do unnecessary damage to someone I'm writing about. And I hope to keep, that they know what they might be getting into. I really try to give them their Miranda warnings. Anything you say can be used against you in my book. And I also think depends on, who your subject is, but people. And Janet Malcolm's not stupid. She knows that this is to the extent that it is a con game, it's one that's both parties are playing, together and sort of it's more like a dance or something.
You also talk about how there's a danger in cocktail party talking about a book, that you can kind of talk it out. And I've certainly felt that.
Actually, more than that, Michael, I really think that some of the best stories are what we call stories of revelation. Not, car chases, not necessarily cliffhanger stories. If you happen onto one of those, it's kind of exciting, but you've got to find something more there. It's the characters or the narrators finding out something. I mean, and what scares me now, I tell that story about having – I was about to write this book called House, which I think was a pretty good book. And it's about, the building of a single-family house and about the sometimes stormy relationships between the builders and the architect and the –
It's really about carpenters
and
the owners.
Ways, yeah. Well, to a large degree, it's about carpenters. And I remember going to a cocktail party when I was in the midst of writing it and someone saying, you mean you're writing a whole book about the building of a house? And for once, I didn't try to justify myself. But I get scared now when I have a story that talks too well at a cocktail party.
That's what you say in the book. If you can't tell it well, it's a good sign.
Could be. Not necessarily, but I don't know.
Well, it's always been kind of thorny for me in terms of my writing life, such as it is. I mean, trying to balance that sense of telling a good story and keeping the trajectory of the story and keeping, a reader engaged and also following instincts, which sometimes need lots of rewriting. I mean, that's what one learns from this.
Right, right. We live in an age, I think, people like to say this, talk about noisy culture, but certainly for immediacy of effect, you can't compete as a writer of books or of long, serious articles, but you don't need to do that. I mean, we do need second thoughts, third thoughts, fourth thoughts. We do need that kind of thinking, that kind of writing, it seems to me.
Well, there's always the old notion that you pre-write, then you write, and then you rewrite, and that each is a major step in its own way. And does that follow?
Well, I think so. I mean, I write an awful lot of stuff that I throw away, but I never feel like it's a waste of time. In some ways, I'm auditioning material. I always hope to have a vastly larger amount of information than I'm ever going to use in a book, and how to figure out what's going to work on the page and what isn't, what can stand for 12 other things. you know, is a matter for me, usually a matter of trial and error. Although once in a while I have a good, you know, good idea at the beginning.
Well, there's also stylistics, and you bring this up in the book, and taste. I mean, in fact, you and Todd seem to be on the same page, so to speak, when it comes to, I'm just giving some examples here, Tipping Point, Preternatural, Proactive, Quintessential, Grassroots, Groundswell. Maybe things to – Orwell has a whole list of these words in politics and the English language that we need to avoid in our writing because they
And we close with all sports metaphors.
There you go, right?
But, you know, Emerson was doing this. And I mean, we do point out that Emerson once said must – I think the words that he thought ought to be banned were words like circumstances or something like that, you know. So, you know, language changes, but one still is – permitted one's own prejudice.
In fact, Orwell didn't like all those foreign words, you know, cul-de-sac, status quo. He thought those were overused, but particularly words like liberal and fascist. We were talking to John Mackey yesterday during this hour. And
oh, yes, I heard.
That all came up. But phenomenon and objective and basic, you know, and utility, these were words that Orwell said should always be avoided.
Right.
But a lot of this certainly has to do with one's own instincts. You know, if a word seems right, but you can also find yourself in the crux of just being overwhelmed by the sense of, I don't know if this is the right word, or this sentence has to be turned around, the words have to be turned around again and again and again.
Yeah, well, it's part of what's fun about it and interesting, I think. You know, a wonderful writer friend of mine who grew up in working class Chicago insists on using the phrase, I could care less, which makes absolutely no sense at all. You know, you sort of want to say, well, why don't you try then, you know? But he insists that that's just the way, you know, language evolves. He would never write that line, though.
How important is style then? You know, I opened up that 50 Shades of Grey and I thought, now admittedly, you know,
<You're> just
I have a certain sensitivity to the English language and I'm a literary guy, but, you know, I felt myself exposed to something quite wretched stylistically.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it can obviously have that kind of effect on a reader.
Yeah, I think
it's an extreme example. But
I think style is something that, you know, you have to discover for yourself and you find it in yourself. And it comes through, I guess, a lot of trial and error. But it ought to be some kind of firm reflection of
But that's
yourself.
What they call voice, and to some extent,
yeah. But I worry about that term because it could that means so much. It's sort of like, you know, one of these terms like ADD or PTSD. What in the world are you talking about? You know,
I think of your books as being in different voices, really, aren't they? It's the same voice, but it's also a voice that changes with the content.
Right. Well, you know, we used to use the word voice for point of view, and sometimes
exactly.
it gets used that way too.
It's almost interchangeable, right?
It gets kind of crazy. I do think that there is this quality. Good prose ought to have a sound, and we know that the great masters of the past in fiction, nonfiction, poetry, all did have voices, but they can't be imitated. They can simply be admired, and you can use them to inspire you as a writer.
And they can be lyrical and uplifting and elevating, and yet at the same time, they don't necessarily translate into speech.
Right.
Which is something a lot of people don't quite get. They're
well, you
almost
know,
like two different languages.
What's the old adage? You know, you should write the way you talk. And what we say, I think, is that you should, if you did that, you know, culture would be a lot worse than it already is, but if everyone did that. But if you write the way you talk on your best day or the way you would like to imagine yourself talking, perhaps that's a better idea.
Our guest is Tracy Kidder. His book with Richard Todd is called Good Prose, The Art of Nonfiction. And let me invite you to join our conversation. We welcome your involvement. You can call us now at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. Again, toll-free from wherever or however you're listening to Forum, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Or email us, forum@kqed.org, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, or go to our Facebook page. A lot of ways to communicate, but join the conversation. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Tracy Kidder, who has been acknowledged as a master of literary journalism and has written a number of books, one of which got him a National Book Award and another which got him a Pulitzer Prize. And his book now, which is co-written with his editor, Richard Todd, is called Good Prose, The Art of Nonfiction, Stories and Advice from a Lifetime of Writing and Editing. I guess the question we're putting out to you, our listeners here, is what is good prose? And, of course, there are many of you probably who want to write nonfiction of one sort or another and may have some questions. I'm also talking about the editorial process, and anybody who's had experiences with writing to any extent knows that there are great editors out there and that there are editors who are perhaps less than worthless, as we put it before we went, Tracy put it before we went on the air. But feel free to join the conversation. And again, you can do that by reaching us at our toll-free number, which is 866-733-6786, or emailing us forum@kqed.org, or posting any questions or comments that you have on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And we also welcome your Facebook comments or your tweets, and you can join us as far as Twitter by going to our handle at KQED Forum. And by the way, tonight, Tracy Kidder will be appearing at the San Francisco Jewish Community Center in San Francisco at 7 o'clock. And tomorrow he'll be at Bookshop in Santa Cruz, also at 7 o'clock. Let's bring some callers on here, and we'll go first with Colin. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, sir.
I just wanted to thank Mr. Kidder for his book, The Soul of a New Machine. It determined the course of my career. I was a mechanical engineer in England. I read the book, and it inspired me to get into computer science. I now run a tech company in Silicon Valley.
Well, you're welcome.
Yeah, what inspired you, Colin? What was it that inspired you?
The description of the freedom enjoyed by the engineers, being rude to their boss, turning up to work at 11 o'clock in the morning, leaving at 2 o'clock in the morning. It was a radical change from what I was experiencing in England.
Well, I you know, it's funny. I haven't read that book in many years, but I have been lately making I'm getting old, you know, and I'm not sure how many more books I want to write, but I've turned back to high tech. I mean, I could never have imagined all those years ago what has happened now.
You turned back to, you mean as a writer you've turned
back
to?
Yeah, I've been following an interesting software person around.
What was most surprising to you about the way that whole Silicon Valley has evolved and that book evolved for you?
Well, after I'd finished it, one of the great things about my job is that I can change the subject completely and keep the same job every 3 or 4 years, 5 years. And I was determined to have nothing to do with that subject after I'd finished that book. So I didn't really pay attention to what had been going on until, you know, as time went on, it was pretty hard not to notice that the computer that I – the team – I watched the team build a new computer for that, and that was what that book was about, what was called a mini computer, no longer – a class of computer that no longer exists. And they did it under sort of extreme circumstances, and they were given a certain kind of freedom – that, as your caller said, they were given interesting work. They weren't given many other rewards, it seems to me. But that's a big reward for a lot of people. But that computer, which I can't remember what it sold for, but it was pretty big. I mean, you know,
it's huge, yeah.
Pretty large physically, and it cost probably $250,000, and it was a mini computer. I mean, now the iPhone in my pocket, not to make an advertisement for that, I don't know how many thousands of times more powerful than that machine. And I do think that's quite, a sort of remarkable fact. I'm not sure that, you know, I haven't got a real feeling about what it's meant. I haven't noticed that the world has improved enormously because of this technology.
That's pretty amazing, as you're
saying. But it is amazing.
Yeah, by your subtext of your own wonder and awe that's coming through here. Does each book have to ignite something in you that is particularly your curiosity and desire to find out what that revelation might be?
Yeah. I mean, basically, though, I start with a person or a group of people. I don't start with a subject. And then I get interested in the subject that preoccupies them. That's the way I understand. I feel like that human character is the engine of all good stories. And that's the way I understand the world best, is through stories. So if I'm writing about a doctor like Paul Farmer, I've got to learn something about tuberculosis and the distribution of infectious disease in the world and so on. And if you're writing about people who are building a computer or designing software, what you know, a whole part of the setting of that story is interior. It has to do with how is it done? What's the, well, you know, what's going on inside their minds or inside the machines?
Well, actually, maybe get a response to you from something that's been going on in my mind because I'm in the midst of trying to finish another book and started out with a subject that I wanted to research in a scholarly fashion, and then I started telling stories, personal stories.
So it's the opposite from the way I...
And so now I'm in this dilemma of, and people are reading it and saying, I really like the scholarship, do more of that, you know, downplay the personal stories. And other people are saying just the opposite, really, you know, dug and liked immensely these personal stories. The scholarship wasn't as interesting to me. Ultimately, you're your own editor.
Right. It sounds like you might have too many editors.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but there's, I mean, that's essentially what I've had adjudicated within myself is I have to be the final editor. And you, even in your relationship with Richard Todd, that's where you come to.
Well, it's true. I mean, finally, I do get the last word. I used to complain that he, when I was writing articles for him at The Atlantic, I was making a list of all the good stuff, I called it, that he made me cut from articles. Because a magazine editor has a lot more authority over you than a book editor. And then, you know, as years have gone by and I've thought back on some of that good stuff, I realized that he was right. And there were a few times when I refused to cut something and have looked at the piece of writing a couple of years later and thought, oh, God, he was right. I don't want to tell him that, though. I hope he's... not listening.
Well,
he's back in Massachusetts.
What about the times he's been wrong, though? I mean,
I'm sure there are times that he's been wrong. But I think those are probably my fault.
But this is a collaborative writing that you're talking about, and yet writing we think of as, well, you talk about it as an art, we think of it as a craft. I mean, it is both, really, in many respects.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, and it is hard. It ought to be harder than it looks, or it ought to look less hard than it is, in fact, in my opinion. But it is, yeah, and it's silly, of course, to – he's the one in this book. This book is written in several voices. We have a kind of assembled voice, the third-person voice, and then we also have parts of it, the book, that are written in the first person. But and it's his voice that he says that writing's, you know, so hard. But I remember walking with a great writer friend of mine down on a Thursday afternoon going fishing, a guy named – wonderful writer named Stuart Dybeck. And we were talking about how hard writing was and – I looked over at him, and he was looking at me, and we both started laughing. I mean, we're not working in a factory. We're, in, you know, we weren't punching time clocks.
But yet, your editor thinks that. I mean, he comes across as believing it's one of the toughest jobs there is.
Yeah, well, that's his opinion.
Well, then he can appreciate you all the more. Jonathan, join us. You're on the air. Hi.
Hi, I'm a student journalist down in San Jose, and I've just a couple questions about doing more nonfiction writing, especially when it comes to the big elephant in the room for students, which is passive voice. And is there a place for passive voice when it comes to writing articles?
Of course. God made the passive voice for a reason, as my editor likes to say. Think about it. What is it? There is a tide, the verb to be and the passive voice. There's a tide in the affairs of men, which taken at the flood leads. Yes, there is a place, of course. And I think that, let's see, what would the general rule be, Michael? I think it's if you're...
Well, scientists will tell you it should be used all the time.
Well, that's different. I've got a rule about this, and I can't remember exactly what it is. Give me a second. I've got my book here.
He's flipping through his pages.
I'm flipping through my pages.
Let me flip through some of your emails in the meantime, but right. While we look for uses of the passive voice. Actually, you mentioned John McPhee. Russ in Berkeley says, John McPhee recently wrote in The New Yorker about organizing a piece of writing. Mr. Kidder, how does this differ from how you organize your books, and also what organizing tools do you use? Index cards, a particular computer program? Talk about organizing your material.
Well,
You're multitasking now, though, because he's flipping pages.
Yeah,
and looking for
I'm sorry. I can't find it. I think, I didn't read McPhee's piece yet. I'm sorry to say. I've been kind of busy, but I will read it. For organizing material is it's in some ways the most important thing. If you are telling stories, factual stories, sometimes it's a good idea to write a rough draft in strict chronological order because then at least you do know the true chronology of things. But that isn't necessarily the final solution. it's a way in which sometimes to proceed if you don't quite know what else to do. But at some point you have to begin to experiment and try to find the you have to discover your story as you write it. It seems to me, or I do. And you and in discovering it, you have to begin to find the ways to structure it that are going to unlock what you what seems most important in it.
What if you can make it more interesting by embellishing it? I mean, this idea of just the facts, ma'am. You know, Sergeant Joe Friday from Dragnet used to say, you know, I think in nonfiction that's a very important cardinal rule, and you certainly make it that. But the facts can be kind of dull, and often are.
Yeah.
I mean, Philip Roth wrote a book called The Facts, where he said, you know, people have been sort of thinking I've been writing disguised autobiography all these years. I'll just lay out my life. And he thought it was really kind of dull to do that.
Right. Well, I think mine's pretty dull, and so I don't usually write in the first person. That's why I go out and look for other people who have more interesting lives to write about. But can I go back to the verb to be and the passive voice for a second?
Yeah, no, I was going to take you back there, please.
Okay. I'll just read what we've written. The verb to be and the passive voice are unfairly maligned. God invented both for a reason. Just turn to the Bible. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God. No one would accuse that verb of weakness. Or Shakespeare. There is a tide in the affairs of men, which, taken at the flood, the verb to be and the passive both. Occasionally, the supposed weakness of a verb can accentuate the nouns around it. Hemingway demonstrates this throughout his work. Any writer should use to be forms without apology when defining or naming or placing something. Consider the passive voice when the thing done is more important than the doer. Don't lean on these usages, but don't contort your prose to avoid them either. How's that?
That's good. And not even one use of the passive voice, just in describing that. Here's Bryce, who says, as an architect, I just want to say how much I loved House. I gave a signed first edition to one of my favorite clients as a housewarming gift a few years ago, and she loved it too.
Well, thanks.
That kind of validation of your work. I mean, it means a lot to writers, doesn't it?
It feels good.
Yeah, it should feel good. Let me get another caller on here. And Roger, join us.
Yes, thank you, Michael. You know, I've had a very rich life. Most people out there probably think they've had a rich life to a degree. But I've tried to emulate four men, four heroes: Jesus, Hemingway, Van Gogh, and Bertrand Russell. Each one of those.
What a quartet, men, yeah.
I've taken a piece of their life. Hemingway, I ran the bulls in Pamplona. I traveled. The only thing I didn't do was kill animals. I did not think that was a good thing to do.
Did you get divorced a lot?
Actually, I did. I've been married five times.
All right. Hey, you beat Hemingway, yeah.
Well, anyway, Van Gogh, for instance. My paintings have become very good. If you go to Cafe Trieste and you look up to the left-hand side, that stained glass, I did those. Even though I'm a painter, the owner at one time, wonderful guy, wanted stained glass. And I felt sorry for the people working behind the coffee thing there because the sun was beating into their eyes. So I did four panels of stained glass. Bertrand Russell, he came into my life at a very important time. I enjoyed his book, Conquest of Happiness. It helped me through something. So it just is very...
Hey, Roger, are you the guest on this show this morning? This afternoon?
I'm sorry, Michael, but I was trying to come up...
No, but there's a point here, isn't there, I think?
No, it is.
Rather than talking about your work and the influences on your life?
Yeah.
All due respect, yeah.
No, I understand, Michael. The point is, I cannot translate all that life experience into a book. I'm frustrated how to bring it all together. I've had multiple experiences, but I can't just bring it all together.
So you have to follow the rule in Tracy Kidder's book. You don't. You talk about it. You talk about it, then you don't have to write about it. You've talked it out.
I don't know. You know, not everything has to be written. You know, not every life has to be recorded on paper. God knows.
Yeah, good advice. Why do you need to write this book, Roger, or feel you need to write this book?
Well, one of the people I like is you, and you write books. But and one last caveat here before I say, I've been married now for 30 years. All that early life I had was exciting and wild and wonderful, a lot of great women. But I settled down, so I'm not jumping around like I did.
And you didn't cut your ear off.
No, I didn't cut my ear off. But I really do want to thank you, Michael, and your guests. It's been wonderful.
Okay, thank you. Well, but, you know, there are people who are looking for the mantle of writerhood, and they want it. Mm-hmm. They want somehow to be they feel they've got a story to tell and it's an important story, or that's something that's set them off to want to write. But, you know, Flannery O'Connor may have said it best. She said, I'm paraphrasing now, but there are too many people who want to be writers.
Right. Well, perhaps that's true. You know, I remember feeling that way about photographers when there was a movie called Blow Up back in when we
Antonioni,
were young. When we were young.
Yeah.
And
big
influence. And it made taking pictures look like a very romantic thing to do. And pretty soon there weren't enough people to take pictures of. I mean, or at least you'd have to take pictures of people taking pictures.
When did you decide to be a writer?
I think I was in college. I've told this story in another book, but I was in college and I'd gotten into a class taught by a wonderful, wonderful teacher and a great translator and good poet named Robert Fitzgerald.
Oh, yes.
And he made it seem like a high calling.
The Rubaiyat, in fact, didn't he?
What?
Didn't he do a translation of the Rubaiyat?
I don't think he did the... Oh, no, that's Edward Fitzgerald. Edward that's a much, much older... Yeah, Fitzgerald's is the Iliad and the Odyssey.
That's
And some other things. But before that, I'd taken a creative writing course in college, and I took it just for recreation because I was going to save the world by being a diplomat. And I wrote some pretty good little stories. I mean, they weren't publishable or anything, but they were unselfconscious. And the instructor in the class liked some of them, and so did the much more important fact was that so did some of the young women in the class. And, you know, I was 19 years old. I think that my first strong impulse to become a writer was that it seemed like a way to meet and impress girls. And it didn't work all that well. But, you know, and then you start down one road and you keep taking turnings and turnings. And pretty soon you turn back. You couldn't figure out how to get back where you started anyway.
So the road taken.
The road taken,
as opposed to, here's Ramona who writes on our Facebook page, the best advice my editor ever gave me, clear your throat a little sooner.
Clear your throat a little sooner. Oh, that's pretty good.
Yeah, not bad. And here's Red in Oakland who says, writing is psychologically hard. It is brutal on self-esteem, even for many good writers. This is the element of writing is hard that is not often discussed.
That's true. That's absolutely true. You know, and you know, one of the problems is one of the things that Todd has tried to teach me over the years, I think sort of by example or gentle being saying funny things, insulting but funny things to me, is that I think it's really easy to confuse who you are with what you write, so that you somehow get your entire identity bound up with what you write. But no one writes well all the time, and sometimes you have to. So getting a little distance on it, just a little, cultivating a little objectivity toward what you've written, and learning to fall out of love with your own words, I think is really important.
It's hard, though, because
it's very hard.
You have to detach yourself from your own ego almost, don't you?
Right.
Your ego is in your writing so often.
Yeah, but if your ego is better served by better writing, then, you know, you can find a way to say, okay, I can throw this away with it, and I can do this better.
You also make a case here in this book for clarity,
very
strong case for clarity.
I believe in that. I'm not sure that – and for the plain style. I mean, mind you, I love Vladimir Nabokov, who's not hardly in the plain style. And I like David Foster Wallace, you know, and regret his absence from
But you also
us.
Like no, Strunk but, and White.
But I kind of like Strunk and White. I think confusion is pretty boring, frankly. I mean, I was particularly on the page. Now, this isn't necessarily true for poetry. A little confusion can
a little
be
confusion helpful. Can be good.
Well, as long as it's not deliberate, you know, it's not. I remember one of the tricks one learned in college, particularly if you were taking a course, say, in fine arts, was if you could write something really confusing, you could usually impress your professor. I'm not you, Michael, I'm sure.
There actually have been recorded instances of writing that was so abstruse as to be really impenetrable, given to various academics, and still got high grades, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But they were proven to be absolutely senseless. I mean, talk about clarity. I mean, it was just the antithesis of clarity. It's hard to make a living as a writer. I think, you know, people have dreams, especially young people, that, you know,
I think it's probably harder now than it was even when I started. And I think that I just should say, right, I've been really, really lucky. And I do believe that anyone who makes a living as a writer and doesn't admit acknowledge the role of luck is almost certainly deranged, diluted at least.
Luck, but, you know, it's the old my old mentor, may he rest in peace, was Walter Tevis, the author of The Hustler or The Man Who Fell to Earth. And, you know, The Hustler was all about talent, but also perseverance and character.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of it's luck, but it has a great deal to do with talent.
Perhaps it does.
Yeah, you're being humble. Of course it does. And there's no gainsaying that in my mind. But, you know, to be a writer, you also have to be pretty literate. I mean, one hopes, and yet there are a lot of successful writers. I mentioned 50 Shades of Grey, perhaps tinged by envy with the success of that book, but extraordinary success.
Commercial success, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it can be done without talent, too.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think that's probably true in all departments of our lives. I do think that in order to learn to write well, you have to read and read widely and also write.
Yeah, I'm certainly with you on that. And you're listening to Forum. We're talking to Tracy Kidder, and I want to remind you that his new book is called Good Prose, The Art of Nonfiction, which is co-written with his editor, Richard Todd. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. Stay with us here. I'm Michael Krasny. And let's also talk a bit about just the importance of structure, because I think a lot of writers don't realize perhaps how important structure is, or would-be writers important. I mean, it's key, isn't it?
I think so. I mean, how you put a story together is, I mean, I think all of these things that we in this book and in English class that we divide up are all, you know, are all of course intimately connected with each other. And if you're writing, or at least when I'm writing, I'm not thinking, well, this is now an issue of structure. I've got to work on the structure here, or I've got to work on just that. It's all there or it isn't. I mean, you're working on everything at the same time, but a wrong structure really makes it hard to write well. And, you know, you start to sense it. You go down a – but what's the solution to that? You know, you have a very complicated story, say, and you – again, for me, the solution when I don't know what to do is just to start. The solution for me is certainly not making complicated outlines. Vonnegut actually had a good line about that, you know, that you use up all the juice and, you know, you don't even want to bother
write
the story.
Yeah.
But I sometimes, as I think I said before, go back to chronology and then begin to find, try to find a better way to tell the story. But I've got this kind of template at that mm-hmm. point or just a timeline.
Or you've just gotten it out there.
You know,
I mean,
it's hard to talk about it for me without telling a story. And the story that I like best about this is a book I wrote called Strength and What Remains, my last book before this one, which is a complicated story. In some ways, very simple, but very complicated too, about a young African guy who escapes both civil war and genocide and ends up in New York City and ends up doing something really good and notable. I had written a whole chronological draft of this thing. There was some good stuff in it, I guess. Dick Todd thought there was. We were sitting on a porch in a house in Maine, though, trying to figure out the first part of this book and where it should begin. And, I mean, there were a lot of little problems that we had realized. You know, to start in Burundi, which was this guy's home country, just seemed wrong to Todd. Once he said it seemed wrong to me, too, because it was such an unfamiliar place, and much better to start him in New York, where we could imagine him more easily. And anyway, that seemed to be the right idea. But we ended up – anyway, we had come to a dead halt, and we're sitting on this porch, and we each had a yellow pad of paper and a kind of nervous silence had fallen between us. And I just doodled a little diagram and finally said, well, Todd, this is all I've got, and turned it to him. And he turned his yellow – he smiled and turned his yellow pad toward me, and he had almost the identical thing. And I thought, well, I said something like we've been working together too long, but I think, you know, at that point we'd understood something, and it is a little bit complicated. It uses one of the venerable storytelling devices, which is to begin in the middle of things in medias res, and it actually did a sort of circle. So it began with this guy fleeing his native country, and ended up at the end of the section with his getting his visa from the consular official in Burundi, saying good luck in New York, and sort of nicely ironic given what we now know about what he experienced in New York.
But it was the right way to tell the story.
I thought so. Yeah. Anyway, it was one way that seemed to work. I mean, but finally, you know, when you find one way that seems to work, you say, thank you. That's enough.
Neil, join us. You're on the air, Neil. Hi.
Yes, I want to know if there are any book critics that have influenced you to any degree or if you have any use for them at all. Have you ever heard of a critic named Wilfred Sheed who died a couple of years ago?
Of course I've heard of him, yeah. I haven't been greatly influenced by them. I've never been greatly influenced by a review of a book of mine, I can't remember, actually. I think once I was by a guy named Lehman Haupt. But Sheed was great. I read Alfred Kazin's, I think it's called...
Walker in the City.
Is it Inland Ground?
On Native Ground.
On Native Ground, yeah. Sorry. I love that book. Forster, E.M. Forster's aspects of the novel meant a great deal to me years ago. And I think you would have to count him as a literary critic as well as a great novelist.
And thank you for that question, Neil. We're coming up to the end of this hour. I just have to ask you a question. This comes from Joel in an email. Thanks so much for your new book. I've enjoyed your others. Look forward to reading this one. Your title, though, begs a question that's been gnawing at me for some time. As a writer and teller of stories, I've never been comfortable with the phrase nonfiction. It's defining what we do by saying what it's not.
Exactly.
Can we come up with a better phrase?
Well, that John McPhee says exactly the same thing, but I'm going to take issue with your use of begs the question. What do you mean? That it avoids the question, or it asks that we do it? This is one of those phrases that we can't use anymore because we don't know what it means. Sure, it's not a very good term.
We'll have to settle for it for now.
How about factual?
All right, there you go. That certainly ties in with the theme of the book, one of the major things. Tracy Kidder, always good to have you with us.
Thank you, Michael. It's nice to be here.
Be at the San Francisco JCC tonight and at... bookshop in, I'm sorry, Santa Cruz, yeah, bookshop in Santa Cruz tomorrow at 7 o'clock. And we remind you that this program is with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour 10 to 11 repeated in the evening, produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Engineer is Danny Bringer. Engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer, Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.